everybody. My name is Mona C, and I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Hi, Mona.
Hi. Tony, again, thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of your day of Al-Anon. And it is always an honor and a privilege to be asked to serve for Alcoholics Anonymous. I was always taught we don't say no. And this is actually the second Al-Anon conference that I've been asked to speak at. So you guys must like me because I guess so. But anyways, I'm just thrilled to be here. We had a really great open share meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous earlier today. So I had some great shares from Alcoholics and Al-Anons. And that was just a great meeting earlier. And I have really enjoyed the speakers here at this open forum today. And thank goodness we have the Zoom deal, you know, that we can all get plugged in and get fed during, you know, this worldly pandemic. So, but we're, you know, we are in unison, whether it's Al-Anon or Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we work together so that we can heal ourselves and that we can be supportive of our family members and our loved ones. And so I am just so grateful for both of the programs. They both played a very large part in who I am today. So I'm going to share with you guys, you know what, my experience, strength, and hope. So my sobriety date is September the 13th of 2005, which means I just celebrated 15 years of continuous sobriety. No weekends off, no putting anything in my body that doesn't belong there, straight 15 years sober. And so I am grateful to God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a darn good tough sponsor, you know, that has helped me to get here. So I'm not real big on drunkalogs. You know, I feel that we all took every last drink that we had to take to get us into the program. But I will share with you, you know, tidbits of that and what got me to my bottom before I got into sobriety. I'm a big book thumper, our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love all of our literature. Al-Anon has some great literature too, which I have read. I'm currently reading a book on Lois, and it's really good. It's just all the conference literature from both programs are just amazing. So, I'll start off by saying, this, I read it in the meeting earlier. So if you already heard it, bear with me. I always read three readings whenever I am asked to share my story. So, on chapter 11, A Vision for You, page 151 of our big book says, for most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good, but not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. There were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society and from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that his loneliness settled down, it thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find some understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily we did, then would come to oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. And I like to open up with that because, you know, my life was a blast. I mean, I was always the life of the party. I like to go to bars. I like to dance, you know, and do all that fun stuff, you know, but you know, I was raised in an alcoholic home. My father was an alcoholic and my stepmom was an Al-Anon. And she was really the one that kind of kept our family glued together, growing up. She really was. And she tried to get me to go to Alateen, but, you know, I just really wasn't interested in it because by the time, you know, I just I was always on my dad's side. I could never understand, you know, what the problem was. I couldn't see things through her perspective. Growing up, I'm going to be 50 next Friday and,
Mona, I hate to interrupt, but can you speak just a little slower for the interpreter?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, I can. You bet. So, I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad was a Budweiser drunk on the weekdays, you know, as soon as he'd get home from work, he'd crack open a beer. And then he was like Wild Turkey and Jack Daniels on the weekend. It was just normal growing up, you know. I was raised around two activities, camping and half mile dirt track car racing. And both of those activities had alcohol, you know, so there was always beer in the ice chest, and we'd go to the racetrack. Dad always had a beer in his hand, and that's just how it was. So, you know, we learn from our environment of our home life, you know, what is the norm? And it wasn't until I got much older that I learned from going and spending the night at friends' house or, you know, being around other children that my home life was not normal. Alcohol just always was. So I never really knew, and I didn't feel any shame or embarrassment around that until I got older. It has been proven medically that alcoholism can be hereditary. And yes, I did catch the bug. As we got older, I recognized the dysfunction and the discord in our family. And my stepmom would go on little hotel sprees, when she was upset with my dad, which would leave my dad and I at home. And again, I was always, you know, trying to defend my dad because I really didn't see things through her eyes. With that being said, I ended up starting to drink right along with my dad, you know, because, that's just how it was in our family. So, when I was younger, I can remember I was the go get me another beer kid. Okay. Dad would be drinking with his friends, whether it was at the, you know, usually camping, and it, go get me another beer kid. And so when I would watch my dad having fun, I wanted to emulate that, right? Because I was such a daddy's girl. And so I would drink the last few swallows of the, you know, the end of the beer when I would go get my dad another beer. And, my dad's friends would always say, gosh, Willie, you know, I would go, you know, to the sleep in the tent. I never had to be asked to get ready to go to bed. And I would always compliment my dad on what a good kid I was. But it wasn't that I was such a great kid. I was smashed and I was going in the tent to pass out, you know, is really what was going on. And the same thing at the racetrack, you know, I would take swallows of my dad's beer because they, you know, he'd always have the big cup of beer that they would sell at the racetrack. And then as we got older and we got more involved with racing, as we would hang out in the pits of the racetrack, and there was always, you know, beer in everybody's ice chest. So that's what we did as teenagers, you know, so it just always was. So that's what it looked like when I was growing up. Fast forward a little bit, my senior year in high school, my dad and my stepmom were split up, and my drinking, and I participated in a lot of outside issues, okay, that we don't talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's an outside issue. So paired with those two things, by the time I was a senior in high school, I was a full-blown alcoholic, and I was really sunk into the outside issues. But my dad's drinking was just really, he held down, he was a bigwig for Ethan Allen Furniture Company. And so he was definitely able to, you know, drink with the bigwigs of the company. And, you know, and that's just what they did. With our family, you know, just divided, my dad, I remember him asking me, now I never addressed my dad's alcoholism. And he knew that I was drinking, but as long as I drank at home with my friends, it was okay. I wasn't allowed to leave the house. And that was just how it was, you know, when I was growing up. I remember my dad saying he wanted to buy me a car for graduation. And I remember I just looked at my dad and I said, you know, Dad, I just want you to come to my graduation sober. Right. And that was the first time that I'd ever addressed my dad's drinking or his alcoholism. And honestly, I really said that because I just wanted my whole family there. And if my dad was drunk, they weren't going to be there. I told my dad, please just come to my graduation sober. And that hit my dad like a ton of bricks. And it was the first time in my whole life I'd ever saw my dad cry. And he realized the effects of his alcoholism. So I was very happy to say my graduation gift was not that I got a car, but my dad got into recovery. He found Alcoholics Anonymous. He came to my high school graduation 5 days sober, and he never took another drink, thanks to his sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, until he passed away in 2002 with 14 years of continuous sobriety. And so he planted the seed. He planted the seed in me of Alcoholics Anonymous. And although I was just beginning and I was off and running, I remember that seed, and I saw what Alcoholics Anonymous did, what AA did for my dad. So my stepmom and my dad got back together, and that was my time to move out on the house and find my own way. And I was just lost. I was absolutely lost, because when you grow up in an alcoholic and chaotic home, things like morals and values and let's apply for colleges and are you getting good grades and, you know, all of those sort of things, they just got put on the wayside. They got put on the back burner because, you know, everything was focused around my dad's alcoholism and my stepmom trying to fix him. And so I think really that's why my sisters and I got so out of control, because we weren't really, you know, parented as we should have been. Do I blame either one of them? Absolutely not. Because you know what? I wouldn't be the woman I am today without my story, right? So I went off and running. My alcoholism just took me way out. I mean, I was always the one that was getting in a fight at the bar. I was always the one that I would be drinking at a friend's house. I'd drink too much. I'd throw up in their closet. I'd sleep with their husband. I was just like, I was terrible. And that's not who I was, who God intended for me to be. And without the booze, that's not who I was. But, you know, that's who I was when I drank. And I participated in outside issues, and my disease just grew and it grew and it grew. And it came to a point where I knew that I needed to do something different. And I did not have the power to do that. I did not have the self-control. I had the willingness, but I did not have what it took on my own to treat my disease of alcoholism. I wasn't a heavy drinker. I wasn't one that had the power of choice, or I could just hang it up because my life was going sour. I had my just entire being was absorbed with this disease that I had absolutely no control over. It. There's no pill I could take. There was no church I could go to. There was not enough willpower. I could lock myself in a hotel room for a weekend and swear off with a solemn oath that I was never going to put anything in my body again. And it just, nothing worked. And it wasn't because I didn't want it. It wasn't because I wasn't willing enough. I was absolutely convinced that I was an alcoholic and I needed help, but I could not do it on my own. I was involved with a man that was, loved booze just as much as I did. I was in a domestic violent relationship, and it was by the grace of God that I lived through that. My mom lived up in this Modesto place, right? I was living in Southern California. She said, come up here and we'll get you enrolled in this Modesto Junior College. You know, you can start over. And she had no idea how terrible of an alcoholic I had become. So I moved up here to this Modesto place, and oh my goodness, what a culture shock from Southern California, right? Like there was, you could get from, I mean, Turlock to Stockton in 15 minutes in 1989, you know, it's not like that way today, but I was bored to death. I started a job at this local video store, Blockbuster Video it was at the time. They're out of business now. But it wasn't, and I got enrolled in this junior college, and it wasn't inside of 6 months that I didn't, you know, didn't find a bar that I could go shake my ass and show my tits and get a bar tab. And it's not because that's what I was seeking after, but that's who I was. Geographical change doesn't help alcoholics. We have to treat the disease, the hopeless state of mind and body that we have to deal with. Until we can find recovery. It doesn't matter where I go. There's a part of our big book that talks about moving to Alaska and running into an Eskimo that has a bottle. I mean, that's us. No matter where we go, there we are, right? So there I was off and running again. I met my him, the domestic violent relationship, and my disease had gotten out of control where my mom and stepdad said that I was not welcome in their home anymore. And I had absolutely no idea what to do. I found out I was pregnant with my daughter, and my mom and stepdad were moving to Oregon, and my him said, "You're not going or I'll hunt you down and kill you." So I was afraid to, I didn't know about all the resources for women that were being battered. It was my first time being in that situation, but I managed to not drink during my pregnancy with my daughter, but I was thrown down a flight of stairs when I was 8 months pregnant by this man in his drunken stupor. And I was stabbed, and it's amazing that I was just alive. There was these, and we lived in this little apartment complex, him and I in Ceres, and there was these Hispanic women there. They didn't speak a lick of English, but they could hear me and him fighting on a daily basis. The police department would come back and they came to know me by first name constantly. And the little ladies would call the police because they were fearing for my safety. And so right after my daughter was born, Officer Lily of the Ceres Police Department, and I'll never forget her, and she came out and she said, "Ramona," which is my full name, "if you don't get a hold of this relationship, you know, CPS and your the alcohol that's going on and the other stuff going on, the CPS will take your child." You know, and that just scared the tar out of me. But her warning was probably the first red flag for me, right? My him got arrested one more time for beating me, but when he got out of jail that night, that was going to be my turning point. He got there to the apartment that day, and I tied on a good one, and I flung the door open, and I had made sure that my daughter was in her crib way away from the door, and I grabbed a cast iron frying pan, and I proceeded to beat the tar out of him. And let me tell you, the little Hispanic ladies, they did not call the police that night. Instead, they stood on the banister and they applauded me. And do you know that that day empowered me in a way that I can never explain, but not necessarily in a good way, but it made me bitter because I found the power inside of me that the more I drank, the more powerful I could be. And now I had found violence. Not that I was beaten anymore, but I found that I could be violent as well, and I could hurt others before they were going to hurt me. So unfortunately, even though I found a victory that day and I got away from my him, my daughter and I were on our new journey. We had to hide out to be safe. And my daughter was just barely a couple of weeks old and I couldn't hold it together. And I was off and drinking again. And completely out of control. And I always thought I was a good mom because I never let her get babysat by anybody I didn't know. I never left her places. You know, I didn't leave her in the car when I went to the bar. You know, I justified and I was in denial, you know, but I got this bitterness and this cold heart because the alcohol was taking a toll on me mentally, physically, spiritually. And then I had this cold bitterness for this man. You know, and today I say I'm a survivor. I'm not a victim of that. I'm a survivor. But I was on this rampage of hurting other people in my life because before they were going to hurt me. And so I burned all the bridges. I was unemployable at this point. I was going from couch to place to place. You know, I'd hustle up enough money to get a hotel room for my daughter and I at the night. And it just wasn't working. I came to a place where I was homeless, you know. And so I had this friend, and she lived in a tent on the river, over off behind Dryden Golf Course on the west side of Modesto. And, you know, at this point, it kind of sounded like a good idea. And I got involved with this man that he liked to go to prison. And that was my qualifications for a good man. I heard it in our speaker meeting earlier today by a gal. She said that she was attracted to, her picker was broke. And boy, I snickered because I could identify with that, you know. And my qualifications were, you know, if you didn't drink, you didn't know how to cook methamphetamines, and you hadn't done 2 years in prison and full of tattoos, like, you weren't worthy of my attention, right? That was my qualifications for a good man, good God. And so him was off to prison one more time. And my daughter was now 5 years old. And we went to go to the county jail to say goodbye through the glass because he was off to prison. And I found out that morning that I was pregnant again, and I was pregnant by him, and he was off to prison. And my daughter called him dad, even though it wasn't her biological father. And she told him through the glass, "Mommy's pregnant." And you could just see the tears in his eyes, because he knew that that child would be born while he was incarcerated. And so when I found out I was pregnant, it should have been a joyful time, right? You find out you're pregnant, you know, the baby shower, and how are you going to decorate the nursery, and, you know, and all this great stuff. Now they have gender reveal parties. They didn't have that stuff when I was pregnant, but that wasn't my first thoughts. I was homeless, right? I was an alcoholic, and all I could think about was, oh my God, I can't drink if I'm pregnant. And that's not normal thinking for most women. A normal woman that finds out she's pregnant and this new life is forming and growing inside of her, it should be a joyous time, right? Not for us that are alcoholics. That's not a joyful news. We worry and we have anxiety about how am I going to drink? Because giving up that child was not part of my morals and values, what little ones that I had, right? So full of fear, anxiety, my hem was off to prison. I was alone. And we were now living ourselves in a tent down the river with my five-year-old daughter. We leave the jail and we hustle back to go down to our tent before dark. And now, mind you, everything that my daughter and I owned, all of her Barbies, all of her clothes, everything that I owned, were all down here in this tent in the river. And we go over this little, like this little dugout so we can get down there. And we stopped. And some kids from across the river, they used to throw stones over at us because they thought it was funny that we were homeless. Well, the kids apparently had gotten across the river and they got a hold of our tent and all of our belongings and just strung it all across the river bend. And I was standing there looking at our whole entire life, everything that we owned, and it was just a shambles. And my daughter, 5 years old, just starts crying. "Mommy, what are we going to do? Where are we going to live? Where are we going to sleep?" And there's just tears pouring down her face. And my solution was I pulled out my bottle out of my back pocket, and I had about, I don't know, a half of a half pint left. And that was my solution. And I finished that bottle, and I found my daughter's sleeping bag in her pillow, and I managed to get her settled down and asleep. And I remember dropping to my knees that night, and I just looked at the sky and I cried out to whom I know my higher power is up there. But I just felt at that instant, there was some divine something going on. And I cried out and I just said, "God, if you're up there," and I meant it with every ounce of my being, "just take my life, get my daughter to her grandparents' house and just take my life. I cannot live this way anymore." And I meant every ounce of my being. And you know, this is how my God works. He was working on this all before I knew about it, but I don't remember falling asleep that night, but I remember coming to in the morning from the Modesto Police Department. They're shaking me, ma'am, wake up. You can't stay out here, ma'am. And they're like, I'm coming out of this fog and there's all these people around me. I gave them some BS story about my boyfriend and I got in a fight. So we were staying the night down there, but they knew better. They knew my daughter and I were living down there. And so I still today can't remember if we had bus passes or if the police department people that were there gave us some bus passes. But up until that morning, it was my pattern to go. My daughter and I would wake up. We'd go clean up in the bathroom at the golf course. And then we'd go to the corner store because I got a bottle. And while she was going off in the store to get whatever she wanted, the guy behind the cash register would always give me one of those styrofoam cups with ice so that I could grab what I was going to drink for the day. While she was busy getting what she was getting from the store, I'd put my booze in the cup and get my lid on it right before she could see what I was doing. And I told her I was sick all the time, that she had to get her own drink. She couldn't drink off mommy's drink because mommy was sick and she'd catch a cold. So now, mind you, I never was paying attention to what she bought because I was worried about getting my own alcohol and getting it in the cup. That morning that the cops woke us up, we didn't go to the corner store that morning. I had to have a drink of alcohol in my blood by the time it was noon, or I was puking and pooping and everything else. I was shaking and everything else. That morning, God was working in me and through me, because when we left the river, we went straight to the bus stop. We got on the bus and we ended up at Doctor's Hospital on Orangeburg and Modesto. We walked into the human resources building or the office there. And you can just imagine what we looked like. We lived on the river. It's not like they have bubble baths down at the river. And so we show up in all our glory. Teeth weren't brushed. Hair wasn't combed. And the lady says, can I help you? And I said, yeah. I said, my name's Mona. And this is my daughter. And we're homeless and I'm an alcoholic and I need some help. And the lady looked at me like with her jaw, and there were some other ladies in the office. And I wasn't so ladylike back then before I got sober. So I had a few choice words because they were looking at me like, you know, I was fearful of rejection and I was full of anxiety. And I said, I'm not leaving till somebody effing helps me. And so this lady, Linda, she was a nurse there, and I'll never forget her as long as I live. She said, she says to me, can I take your daughter to the cafeteria to get her something to eat while you ladies sit down and talk? Okay. So I looked at her and I looked at my daughter, and my daughter's face was just filthy. And she had tear marks that you could see through the dirt from where she had cried herself to sleep the night before, asking me, mommy, what are we going to do? And I looked at my daughter, and it was that moment of clarity that I'll never forget. And I said, yes, Linda, you can take her to the cafeteria, because I was thinking in my head and remembering all those mornings we went to the store. I couldn't remember the last time I fed my daughter, because I was always worried about getting my alcohol. I don't really recall anything that she ever bought at the store. I don't know when she had her last meal. And I looked at that Linda lady and I said, please take her and get her something to eat. And she said to me, is there anything that she can't have? And I know she meant, was she allergic to milk or nuts or anything? But I'm thinking, no, you get that baby anything she wants, because she deserves that. And my daughter was so happy because she came back with like an armful of, you know, different stuff. And she got to go eat whatever she wanted at the cafeteria. And I was determined. I was determined from that point forward. My motivation was always, all I wanted in the whole wide world was to be a good mom. And in that moment, I knew I had an opportunity to change my life and be a good mom to my mom, my daughter, and the baby that was growing inside of me. So in just like very short order, that seed that my dad had planted in me of Alcoholics Anonymous came to life, and there was like this tree growing out of me all of a sudden, and everything made sense. And so we got CPS involved. And they said that they were willing to put me in a treatment program for free. And that's what I needed, because I didn't have a penny to my name. So we got signed up for that. My daughter went to go stay with her grandparents. My son was born July 1st, 2005. He is now 15 years old. And he went to foster care for a few months. And I was able to go into a treatment program and get sober. And I'll never forget the first night that I was there, because I got to take a shower, a hot shower. I got a toothbrush and some toothpaste. I got a clean pair of clothes. I got some underwear, and I got a bra, and I got a pair of socks, and I got a pair of shoes. I got to sleep in a bed with clean sheets and a pillow. I got a pillow, and there was a kitchen there, and they said that I could eat whenever I was hungry. That was an amazing, amazing first night in recovery. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. But the next morning came and I was DTing. And so I was going to go to the office and tell them I didn't need their treatment program. And as soon as I walk in the office, there's somebody, this is how God works in my life. I have to have people that I know, right? So I can feel comfortable. And there's a man that I knew from my past sitting in the treatment center office. And I was like, oh, Bob, you remember me, Mona from the West Side, right? And I was tore up, and he did not even recognize me. And I was like, you know, this is a women's program, right? And he just snickered and he said, Mona, I'm not here for treatment. I've got 5 years sober. I work for the men's program, and I'm here to take you to a meeting today. And I was like, no way. I thought this guy was in prison or dead, right? And there's God putting him in my life, because if it wasn't for my friend being there, I was going to leave, right? So we started going to AA meetings, and it was really cool because my friend worked for the program and he was the one that picked us up. So I felt like I could breathe, like there was somebody that understood me. I didn't have to go on this recovery journey alone. Well, lo and behold, we go to the meeting, and everybody that I thought was dead or in prison was it at the AA meeting. Who would have thought? That's where everybody, all my friends that were gone, were hiding out, the secret society of Alcoholics Anonymous. How dare them, and not include me, right? Well, they were trying to include me, but I just didn't want to listen. So there I was, like all the people that I used to run with, everybody I felt comfortable with, they were all there and they were getting recovery. And man, I just was so excited, right? So they said, get a sponsor, work the steps, you know, and just basically do the steps or die. So I got a home group. I got sober at Modesto Fellowship, which is definitely the roughest fellowship in town, but they cussed. And they said God in the same sentence. They smoked cigarettes, and there was motorcycles lined all up and down the beginning front of the building. And that was my kind of place. And that was my home group for the first 10 years of my sobriety. And you know, what I learned was that I needed to get into service, and I became a service junkie. And Bill and Bonnie will probably shake their head because they know me very well. I've been off and running with service work for the past 15 years. And one of the greatest joys of being in service, not just chairing meetings or, you know, being a GSR or doing those things, but sponsorship, right? I had such an amazing sponsor, and she taught me well, because I got to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to other women. One of my sponsorees joined us in our open AA meeting that we had earlier, and she got to read the traditions. And she's just one of many beautiful women that I've got to carry the message to. But our big book says on page 89, working with others, life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover and to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends, this is an experience that you must not miss. We know that you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. And boy, I tell you what, some of the greatest joys since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous is carrying the message to other women in the program. It's been a really cool journey, you know, being of service to my home group. Now I've switched home groups. My home group now is Northside Fellowship, and they've been my home for a little while now. And it wasn't that I outgrew Modesto Fellowship, but we didn't have a women's meeting. And I was at 10 years sober, and I'd done every single service position there was to do at my home group, except the building coordinator, because I break stuff. I don't fix it, right? But I needed a women's meeting. And so my sponsor encouraged me to visit some other fellowships that had women's meetings. And that's when I landed at Northside. And I got hooked up with my buddy, Sean G. And Sean was the chairperson for Northern California Council of Alcoholics Anonymous. And him and I started hanging out together a whole lot. And he introduced me to NCCAA. And I just like fell in love with that conference committee. And I ended up becoming the interior secretary of the whole Northern California Council of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I lived in a tent on the river 15 years ago, you know, and they trusted me with like doing this amazing job. And it was the coolest ride. And my term, we're on the interim right now because of COVID, but going and being a part of AA just outside of Modesto, like going all over Northern California and carrying the message in these conferences, like all over, I've met the most amazing people. I've met the most amazing friends. And I got to have a real connection with people in Al-Anon, because we always have an Al-Anon program in our conventions, right? And that's where I met Bonnie. And I love Bonnie with my whole heart. She's my favorite AA. And she's and her husband, Bill, have very, very much been a significant part of my heart since I've met them. But being involved with NCCAA has been such a joy. And
Mona,
yes,
we're a little long. Can you wrap?
Absolutely. And so that was the greatest service commitment, I would say, thus far. And so that's actually the last thing I wanted to point out, was that service was going to really be the greatest highlight of my recovery. And I will close with this. This is on page 164 of our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize that we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us, and ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. So abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past, give freely of what you find, and join us. We will surely be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.